There isn't a business or industry that isn't going through some form of digital transformation. And in that digital transformation, there is new business models emerging with new products and services. In order for a company to actually do this in a unique way, you have to have a CDO. A CDO, a chief design officer, isn't just someone who's going to help you build your brand, but they're actually going to help build the organization that will make it work on behalf of customers. And while empathy is really important, I would tell you action is even more important. The ability to deliver a result.
Hi, I'm Juliana Proserpio, and welcome to Desired, the podcast from Echos, designed to help you be bold, stay fresh, and become a better design and innovation leader. Hopefully, we can help you not only predict the future, but create it through the lenses of design and innovation. In this episode, we're going to chat with Joana Penha. Joana is the head of research and design for Alexa devices at Amazon. Is a 21st century Renaissance woman, a design technologist, known as the mother of cognitive experience design. She's propelled by the multidisciplinary acumen in design, code, data, media, and technology. Her insatiable curiosity moves the C-suite beyond obvious ideas and products towards enduring market-making experiences for the connected era. Joana was also named one of 2020's most powerful women internationally by Fortune, a power woman of New York, 2019 president of the DAD Digital Jury, and one of Silicon Alley's top 100 rising stars. Her creativity and design leadership are fueled by the belief that human truth, data, and creativity are inextricably linked to the designing inventions that matter for business and spaceship Earth. So, Joana, thank you so much for joining us.
It's such an honor to be here. One of the things that I love about this podcast's name is the word desired. In Spanish, I am a very proud Latinx woman. In Spanish, it often is reduced down to ganas. What is it that we have ganas in achieving? And I think ganas is a part of that passion that we bring to design as Latinx women who lead in this field. So it is such an honor to be on a podcast that's all about having ganas for design.
Amazing. I'm so happy to hear that. Thank you so much. It's all about ganas, then. I love it. And look, it is really, really excited to have you here. You are an amazing design leader. I read in your LinkedIn some recommendations that you are a well-recognized design leader, obviously. And you inspire your design teams and help to push boundaries, as well as being an advocate who can make things happen with the C-suite. And one person specifically said that you have a combination of leadership and substance that is rare and powerful. So how did you become such a good leader? And what means design leadership to you?
If I can take you back to, you know, what influenced me in my life to be a great designer, I'm gonna tell you that I am a second generation designer who was born out of a brilliant designer and grew up in a design studio that was run by my mother. And so I often, you know, as much credit as I give all of the bosses that got me to the place that I was here, right? Because you learn just as much from the bad bosses that you do from the good bosses. But I had a very, very stable foundation and a mother who showed me how to balance business and the art of design, the art and science of design, that this craft that we have and the importance of design isn't always just about making it look better, but it's about making it work better. And I, you know, grew up watching her build a business over 30 years and being awarded by the President of the United States for being like one of, you know, the most recognized designers in the United States. And I always thought to myself, how do you beat that? And by the way, at the time, I didn't even think I wanted to be a designer. Because as every, you know, goofy teenager does, we go, oh, no. We want to do exactly the opposite of what our parents and see if we get to a different path. And here was the reality. It took me to the same path. So there is something that is in destiny of what you're, if you follow your purpose, that you will end up on a very similar path. And so clearly design is in my blood. It's in my DNA. And the leadership portion has been an amalgam of watching people like my mother from a very early age build a business, but also build a culture and a team around that business. And one that where she created trusted relationships about just being real with people and understanding that the business of design is one that balances the trade-offs in life. And so, you know, I had a really good blueprint to start with. It wasn't by magic by any stretch of the imagination. And then I think the other part of the leadership thing has been purely sticking to my purpose, not looking at checking boxes in the path, but looking at how, as a designer, do I go from the kinds of problems I'm solving today to bigger problems? How might I apply this skill that I have, this superpower that I have, to take really unique problems and study them and then actually apply a solution, right, that is used by millions of people and try to be humble in it? You know, I think there are many, many times in my career where you are so celebrated, but often you tend to lose, when you are that celebrated, that you lose that sense of humbleness and connectivity to the people that you are designing for. And I think the, for me, my team and putting together teams begins with understanding that we are all learning how to solve problems. And there is no one specific way to solve a problem. You know, I look at how do you create an environment that is a learning environment, right? Because we as designers should see ourselves as lifelong learners. The second part is ensuring that people have purpose. And then the third part was giving them the space that they need to exercise that purpose and vision. You know, great managers look to help cultivate that. And, you know, often I've actually just recently gone through with my own team here at Amazon, a practice that I have done for the last 15 years with every designer that I've ever worked with, which is let's create a career plan. And the first part of that career plan isn't, hey, I want a promotion to the next thing. That's inevitable, right? That's small thinking. That let's use this process just the same way that we dream big for our customers, to dream big for ourselves, our communities, our families, because that's what career means. People forget that, you know, a career isn't always just about climbing a ladder, but often it is maybe economic empowerment to somebody who is maybe a first generation designer, right? I mean, design is a very privileged discipline. And so if you have the privilege of being in it, you want to ensure that what you're doing is making sure that people have the dream, that they have the skills, that they have the pathways. And the most important part of this is the sponsorship. I hear a lot of talk about mentorship. I got to tell you, as a Latinx woman who has seen, you know, enough in my lifetime, is that while mentors are great, sponsors are what we need. And so when you are able to take those four key pillars and put people on a path to their purpose and empowering not just their dream, but assuring that their dream aligns to the organization they're with or the company that they're with is really critical. And so that has been always my philosophy of doing that. But I will tell you, it was purely, like all great designers, a learning out of observation. And it has come over time. And it's also continuing to humble yourself in that the moment that you stop designing as a leader, you've stopped being a designer. And so if you're only in the business of managing designers, then you never understand what it is that they're trying to understand. And so it is humbling yourself to understand that we are in service to the people that we are creating for, but also from a team perspective, you are in service to creating a culture of progress and hope and optimism in a, you know, in a world right now that doesn't have a lot of that.
Wow. You just wowed me. In the first question, the listeners can't see, but I'm taking so many notes that I have already like two full pages. Thank you so much for sharing that.
There's something that intrigued me that you talked about, not only having mentors, but having sponsors, right? And I think this is connected to your relationship and your, I think, what you have been recognized, that you really push the boundaries with the executive and the C-levels. How do you do that? And how do you think that you practice these skills to become a good, I think, design leader and a C-suite as a designer, but also being able to push the boundaries for the people and with the people who are the sponsors usually of ideas and projects?
Absolutely. So let me just start with, as a design leader in an organization, it's about preparation. And it's also about walking into the door with the confidence in yourself to know that you'll learn. If you don't know it, you'll learn enough to get there. I really try to approach every single day in a way that I'm trying to learn something new. And it isn't always about, it may not be always about design, although I do think the whole world is designed, some of it unintentionally. And so when you deeply want to understand human behavior, you walk in humbly and you listen to the cues of where you can insert your insight. And I think that's a super important. Preparation is so much, you know, when I'm working with the C-suite, I probably do at least the 7 to 14 days pre-reads and research about what the business problems are, what the market understanding is, and trying to dive deep into, you know, here's where they are. This is the, you know, often with C-suite leaders, they're looking for a narrative to guide an organization. And as somebody who guides an organization, you have to be able to gain that confidence and trust in them that you're not going to steer them off of a cliff, you know, and you do so, but you can be bold and audacious, but then you have to answer their questions and understand that when you're running a Fortune 500 company, that there's enormous risk involved in it also. And so it's humbling yourself to understand the risk and help them mitigate the risk so that they can get to the future that they're trying to design. And so for me, you know, the first part of that is painting different futures. And it's about picking a path, maybe picking multiple paths to see which one actually works for the company, but always ensuring that we are prepared, that you've done the homework before you've walked in. And not because you want to go in as a know-it-all, because you want to deeply understand once you have the floor and a seat at the table that you're able to contribute in a way, right, that says, here's a market-making idea. It might work. It may go completely on its ear. But if you don't try it, you'll never learn anything institutionally. And that's, you know, it isn't tough to ask people to learn with you or to bring your learnings in such a way that says, maybe what I have learned from this other industry may apply to yours. Or maybe some of this research that I've been doing, you know, for the last 10 years in the area of like mobility. So I've worked a couple of spaces. The first one happens to be in what we call cognitive experience design. And cognitive experience design is all about working with AI, or what we call also ambient computing. It's what, you know, essentially is this beautiful device here that happens to be an Amazon Echo. How do you begin to create ambient Internet of Things devices that are useful and magical, but yet are very much a part of the environment that you are in and that become multisensory, but that balance the needs of privacy and ethics and bring that to the table? And so I think often, you know, as a leader, you want to bring all of that and ask the hard questions of your team, ask the hard questions of yourself. I don't ask my team anything that I wouldn't be willing to do myself. And then the second part of that then becomes then asking those hard questions of a CEO and having the confidence to do so. Never assume anything. It's, you know, do your homework and you won't have to assume.
That's really important. Thank you. So you touched point on so many, many important things. You were talking about being a design leader and the rise of this position of being a design leader. You were also talking about cognitive experience design. I'll start asking you a few questions about these things. So the first one, You were also mentioning in a chat with Envision about the rise of the CDO, the Chief Design Officer, as symphony maestros, and they also need to be deeply empathetic. What do you think that are the traits, and what is the challenge of CDOs, and why? Basically, I think that the most important question is, why are they upcoming and a more common position nowadays? Because it changed a lot in the past 10 years. We didn't have as many CDOs as we have nowadays. Why do you think this is mattering so much nowadays for these organizations?
So if I take a step back and I open the aperture just a little bit, when we think about what's going on in business and industry, right? There isn't a business or industry that isn't going through some form of digital transformation. And in that digital transformation, there is new business models emerging with new products and services. In order for a company to actually do this in a unique way, you have to have a CDO. A CDO, a chief design officer, isn't just someone who's going to help you build your brand, but they're actually going to help build the organization that will make it work on behalf of customers. And while empathy is really important, I would tell you action is even more important. The ability to deliver a result, even if it's not the intended result, but delivering a result is better than just being empathetic. And I think often we think about empathy without the action. And you got to have both to be successful. You must be empathetic to the customer needs, right? And so you have to take immediate action. At Amazon, we call it a bias for action, right? You have to have a bias for action and a customer obsession, because inevitably what you are doing is what is fueling the bottom line revenue for the company. And so if you're a new company, or you're a company that was born digital like a Netflix or an Amazon, right, we are making the products. And so we have to listen to customers in such a way that we are then taking that leadership all the way up, you know, to Jeff Bezos or any one of his S team, right, to be able to make the case for something new or to fix something old. And so you have to be able to, I think there is a level of empathy, but there's also a bias for action, and being able to articulate the importance of a certain data point and bring new thinking into it. So that's, I think, kind of number one piece of it. The second part, and this is one that I can't overstate why the CDO is becoming, the rise of it, is that I think there are plenty of companies throughout the world who have realized that a well-designed product is a well-designed business. And when you have well-designed operations and you have well-designed supply chains, they are able to weather any storm. And I think this pandemic has given way to old industries that had poorly designed systems and poorly designed supply chains that effectively fell apart on us during the pandemic, that could not deliver to the end customer. And so the people that could and had well-designed services and processes, things, are the people who have weathered the storm that almost were made for this pandemic, right? We're made for this new brave world. All of this is done by design. It is intentional. And if you're at the beginning, and I look at it and I think so much about some of the work that I do in the not-for-profit world and in the social business innovation world, one of them happens to be with an organization called designedbyus.org. And in this, what we teach is creating and incubating new ideas to take on some of the world's problems. So at the beginning of the pandemic, the teams of the design core put together a studio called the 100 Million Mass Mayday. And the reason for that was because big companies failed to see something like this happening and couldn't work and orchestrate an ecosystem of setting up manufacturing in the United States for PPE for hospital workers. And here is a team of college students or recent college graduates or apprentices who come from underrepresented backgrounds, if given the chance, wanted to put their talents to service. And here was a primary example of how I said, two women in a basement with ganas can change the world. And so they did. But you have to be able to mentor that and incubate that and foster that and create a safe space. Just as we create a safe space for, you know, huge monetization, this team is now figuring out that, you know, in order to do this, this is about creating now these ecosystems that don't rely on completely foreign supply chains. And so these were people who had never had any experience in supply chain, but all of a sudden became experts at it because they had to. And so when you look at this as a leader, it's about taking crises and turning them into opportunities to learn and create things that do matter for the world and that can be used by millions of people.
Yeah, and sorry, that to me is the role of the CDL.
No, I think it's amazing because there is this famous quote that don't waste a crisis, right? Of course. And this has been proving us that it is a great opportunity to create change in the most fundamental levels of our organizations, but also of our societies. Like you were saying, there were some solutions that were just not right. They were not fitting the purposes, or they were not delivering the best ways because they were poorly designed or unintentionally, they didn't have any kind of intention when designing it. And then basically when something happens, there is this challenge, there is this problem, right? So one thing that I'm also curious, I don't know if you can answer or not, but if you could, I think it would be very enlightening for other designers and innovators out there. How do you structure your design team in Alexa Research and Design? How does a design and a team works? Do you work on squads? How many people are in a team? How do you divide them by products? Or do you have UI, UX? What kind of, let's say, segments in design do you have there? Could you tell us a little bit about that as well?
Absolutely. So let me start with something that is so unique to our peculiar Amazonian culture is the idea of a two pizza team and the leadership principle of frugality. And it comes from a place that understanding that means that you don't have to have an enormous team and you don't have to have a tremendous amount of resources to actually make something work. And when people come together in these small two pizza teams, two pizza means that the entire team should be able to eat two pizzas. Working in that capacity is where I think that how we organize ourselves. And design crosses the spectrum of human factors and ergonomics in our industrial design practice, voice, right? Think about, you know, voice as an interface design, visual as an interface, gestures. I think about the trajectory of what we're working with today. And we're really, you know, we think about hardware, software. The closer we get to multisensory artificial intelligence, we're also talking about wetware, right? How many of you have a pair of Echo Buds that are now sitting in your ear? Right, that's a microcomputer that is now sitting in your, you know, in everyone's ear that has a sensory ability, right, through sensors, but also we are impacting a sensory piece. So the closer and closer you get to the cellular form of the human body, you know, you do come to a place of understanding what wetware is and where we may be going. And so our teams are structured in a way that are designed to operate and solve these problems. And they do so in a really small way. You know, we have UX writers, we've got, we've designed technologists. You know, I came up through the path of design technology. I was always like the digital guru at the agencies and stuff like that. And when I owned it was because I could build the things that I envisioned, right? And when I was worked back in the day when you worked in Photoshop and then you could translate that into code. And that's what I did. And so that skill set, I think, is really important and now has become so critical to the success of designers everywhere. Because if you're a visual designer and you want to see kinetic type, how do you make it? Or how do you make that work? Why would you relegate it to a production company? Isn't a part of design understanding the canvas that you're trying to work with? And so thinking a little bit about that, you have to have both a technical ability in design, but you also have to have the practical aesthetic of design. And when those two things come together, I think that's the magic that we try to look for, that combination of somebody who understands the broad basis of design, right? That T-shaped designer, but within that T, you gotta have technology. And this is gonna be true of every designer across the world, whether you are designing a chair or a Peloton bike or a hydro rowing machine or a lovely speaker, right? Ambient devices that's in your home. If you don't know about tech or you don't know how the thing works, it is really tough to get to the end solution and orchestrate what you need to orchestrate to be successful.
That's really interesting because I guess one of the things that if you don't know the language or if you don't know the tech, you get limited because you're going to be using probably some form or some shape of old technology that it's not the best solution that you could be leaning towards because you just don't have the means, right? So I think I absolutely agree with you. I also wanted to touch on something that you mentioned earlier about cognitive experience design. So you are the mother of cognitive experience design. And you said in your website, it says that it's the art of empathetically respecting an individual's time and choices while balancing the science of crafting data into intelligent, individualized experiences that lead conscious decisions. So the best cognitive experience design expertly reframes cognitive technology, AI. And this is the new artistic canvas. So could you tell me more on how you have been working with cognitive experience design and what are the principles behind it? How do you go from the more strategic part of using cognitive experience design to the last mile of design? I would love to know more.
Absolutely. So I think asking about the principles, I think, is so critical in this, and that the core principles of cognitive experience design is understanding that you're working with often machine learning or natural language understanding. And a part of that is the human teaching the machine. The other part is also often impacting the human. And so much of the work that we do in Alexa devices is cognitive experience design. It comes in the form factor of the last mile might be the voice interaction experience that you are having with them. What's the golden that's going to wake Alexa's special skill, right? That you might be looking for, whether that is I'm looking for a new recipe or I need, help with my fitness or what music do I want to listen to? You know, there's so many different skills around this. I started with the idea of cognitive experience design while I was working at IBM, and I thought it was really important because at IBM, we were the leaders in AI at the time with Watson and enterprise. And so a big part of what you're attempting to do is in a world filled with data, that people are inundated with data, you're trying to create an experience in which they don't feel inundated and you're respectful of their time. You're actually reshaping time. Your design should reshape time in a way that makes the interaction more human and more natural in such a way that it actually lessens the cognitive load you need to do with the interaction. So for instance, voice design, right, actually lessens the cognitive load of me if I am driving a car and I've got my mobile phone over here and you're driving. If I have to look away, that's putting cognitive pressure on me as a human being. It's taking me away from the primary task that I am doing. But if I am able to engage with a voice, right, that takes less cognitive. It's actually more natural. So think about it in the way that it is, it often, somebody recently says, is cognitive experience design the same thing as ambient experience design? It's absolutely, because ambient is about bringing AI into ambient computing in a way that's a little bit more ubiquitous. And so what this really gets down to is building people the cognitive path for things to happen in a natural order, using mental models to then utilize AI for that last mile to help them make a decision faster than they would before, to bestow a piece of intelligence on it when they needed it. Something as simple as giving directions. Walking down the street, I've got my earbuds in, and what I'm really looking for is a safe place to have a cup of coffee or a glass of tea in a pandemic. How might I get that experience? And that experience might actually come through my Alexa-enabled earbud, right, which are called Echo Buds, and that comes through a VUI. So, if you think about it from here's the big strategic thought that we actually have to introducing more information into people's lives shouldn't be what we're doing, but yet we have done because we're producing more and more data than we know what to do with. The brain cannot process them, which tells you you got a really bad experience. And then siphoning it down to individualized experiences that make sense to where you are, when you are doing it, at the time that you're doing it, and doing so in the most natural way. Voice might be the next one. Haptics might be a better one. There are times when visual is okay and better. It's just trying to decipher that not everything in the world starts like this.
Yeah, with this
right? Thing, yeah. Because that isn't how we naturally move through the world. It certainly was. I mean, we now do that, by the way. We now move through the world that way. And we've had to adjust, but the vast majority of people do not. And so you want to make your design accessible to everyone of all cognitive abilities. That's the real key for me, is that when you combine it with inclusivity, the first principle of cognitive experience design is inclusivity. And understanding that human health and ability is a part of it. The second part is what we do with data and the ethics in what we do with data. And really the third part of this is, and how much time do I have to do it? Right? I look at it as like, who are we designing for? What is it that what superpower am I bestowing upon them? And how much time will it save? Those are the three W's. You know, the wow that I look for is, wow, that took a lot less time, right? So you go, what is it, you know, who is it for? What's the problem it's solving? But more importantly, what is it doing for them? As a kid who read comic books as a kid, you know, and by the way, as an adult too, I shouldn't just say as a kid who read comic books, I still read them. They're now called graphic novels.
Okay.
I am a child at heart. Right. Whatever. I'm addicted to Mandalorian. That is like unbelievable. So, but if you think about that, and you think every one of the main characters, that story arc, has a cognitive experience design. Why? Because there's something augmenting the human form to help them, give them superpowers. Is that to fly? Is it to give them x-ray vision? Is it giving them extra sensory hearing? What is it that I am bestowing upon that customer? And then even more importantly, that superpower, so that what we're doing is creating superhumans, not super machines. Yeah. And I think that at its core is one of the key principles, that this is never about, you know, I look at tenants and think this is not about machines talking to machines. This is about humans connecting with machines in a way they haven't before. With the explosion of the Internet of Things, with billions of sensors along every supply chain, we are looking at connecting everything to everyone. And the problem that poses is data overload, cognitive overload. We are always in a state of cognitive overload. If you are constantly in your social feed, you are in a state of cognitive overload. Half of my Twitter, for those of you who follow me, thank you so much for following me. It is such an honor. But honestly, it is pre-thought in a bot that I programmed many years ago. you'll see. Sometimes it feels like there's stuff that's like of the now that's definitely me. But you know, I do check in on my bot and have done some machine learning from time to time. But the important part of that is that I know, as, you know, someone who balances research and design, can't have one without the other. There is both science and the art. The science, the objective scientific piece, is like, I want to stay connected to my tribes. I want to stay connected to those things. But I also have a job to do, in training a team and doing all those things. And that, you know, allows me, it enables me to scale my expertise in a very different way. So this is about scaling human expertise and not the replacement of humans. And I think so many of us have that fear when we talk about cognitive experience design. It's like, ooh, we're connecting into the machine. It's like the Matrix. I'm like, no, it's not that cyberpunk talk. It's this story, the one that we have yet to write, that we'll write together as experienced designers, understanding that we begin with the human brain and we work through the need for it.
I think that is so interesting to hear. Let me just say that, and you just reminded me of something, that our visions of the future, it's been a while already that we have been following a lot of science fiction, and it made us kind of believe more and more, especially in the past I think 30 or 20 years, that the future is going to be formed in some sort of, it's going to happen like we have been watching in our Black Mirrors or any kind of Handmaid's Tale. It's going to be a dystopia, right? And what I think that you are bringing is that it's more like a design fiction, that it's more informed, it's more intentional. It doesn't have to be something that is going to be, we are making machines that are more intelligent that are going to be ruining the world, but it's the other way. How do we augment human traits and we make it more interesting and so that they can save time, so they can do other things better? And on that note, I just wanted to ask you something, because you were talking about how much working with cognitive experience design helps us to not rely so much on visuals, right? So on screens and on other kind of ways of understanding and interfering and interacting with other kinds of technologies. But there was something that I heard, a concept that whatever you design, designs you back, right? How do you think that these kind of new interactions that we are creating that are not only visual, because humans have been relying on visual cues so much, how do you think these other kind of interactions are designing us back? Positively and maybe negatively as well. Is there any things that you have been observing already?
Yeah, so I work very closely with the disability community. As someone who has a disability, let me start with, you know, I am a dyslexic kid from San Antonio, Texas, who, you know, grew up with a cognitive disability. And in understanding that work has a lot to do with the work that I do today, which is understanding that we all have mental acuity differences across the globe, and that what we should be designing for is that is inclusive of all of those. I love that this idea that what you design is designs you back. And that's absolutely right, because so much of the part of what we design is a learning process. I think often we're trained in design school to really focus in on craft as opposed to the critical thinking part. And I have to push on design thinking a little bit, because I think the world has been wowed by it. But what I'd like to see it balanced a little bit more with design doing. You know, I think IDEO has done a revolutionary thing in making design thinking hit the world. Here's what they haven't done. It's actually the design doing portion of it and bringing products to market, having them fail, and do so in a way that actually improves that process. With all of that being said, when I think about the kind of the applicability of design in the realm of cognitive experience design, it is understanding that this is a learning process, is one that is not an academic practice, but often a practice of business by design. And when you are not intentional, you get dystopia. Let's be very clear. We're living in a dystopian future we did not design.
Yeah.
Or we lacked the imagination to believe it needed to be designed. Yeah. And I fundamentally believe that we as designers are the writers of the next chapter of this future. That design is about storytelling, because you could design something so amazing, right? But if people don't believe in it, they'll never use it. So one of the things that we do, and it's interesting because it was a practice I certainly always did prior to Amazon, and has been something through my design career, we called it speculative design. And we would write what I would call it 12 tomorrows, right? We would write stories. It was almost like a letter to ourselves 5 years in the future. And then you get to pick which future you would bring to life, right? Well, here at Amazon, we do something very similar, if not almost exactly the same, which is called the PRFAQ. It's a press release and a set of FAQs. And it is a promise to our customers. It is that speculation of where we must go, with the FAQs of our intention in that document and through the process of writing that document. By the way, it's not just a one and done. It is the product design and development process at Amazon that begins with a narrative. And your job as a designer is not just coming up with the narrative. That's the easy part. The hard part is making it real.
Yes.
And so that is where I would say that the need for not utopian. It's almost the same side of a different, different side of the same coin, right? It is having a utopian future is the same coin as having a dystopian future. But what about a well-designed future that works for 100% of humanity, that does so in a way that doesn't disenfranchise anyone? We can strive to get there. A part of the work of a designer is to have not just hope, but we have the skills to make that hope become a reality. And a part of us is ensuring that it doesn't have to become a reality in one launch, that it's incremental, that it helps bend the arc of justice in the way that you want it to be bent. And so when I think about it, whether I am designing a brand new product or a mask for medical professionals that is eco-friendly, or we are thinking about how do you redo ventilators, you know, portable ventilators for hospitals for the pandemic, or how do you design something that you are doing so in a way that is solving real problems? We often think about this as utopia or dystopia, as opposed to what the real goal behind this should be. Is about designing a planet, designing our world for 100% of humanity, and getting you to bend the arc of justice and be intentional in every solution that you do, whether that is that you are designing a pair of headphones to the chair. Does that chair actually help somebody who may not have limbs, right? Who may have a disability in some way, shape, or form and needs to have something that isn't what we call a disability dongle? You know, that is, you know, somebody who's designing for my community that doesn't understand the real problem. So, you know, for designers, I think so often we sit in these ivory towers and we've got really cool hair and glasses and stuff. And what my challenge to them is write a narrative that takes you out of your utopia and privilege and gets you into a community that needs help. Maybe it's your own community, right? That needs water. That needs basic health services. This is where design is needed the most. And this is where business now understands that we are uniquely suited. I've actually gotten very excited about that not only business understand it, that government understands it. When you see the rise of the chief design officer in cities across the globe tackling things like climate change, we can do this. But we have to be the architects and the writers of the next chapters of humanity. And we have to commit to it.
That's beautiful. Thank you for bringing that up. And I remember that when I was in uni as well, studying design, obviously, we wanted to get to the strategic seats, to the C-suites. And this was like a wild dream, right? Because no designer has ever landed there. And then now, I agree with you, we're not only in business, but we are in governments and we are designing the next chapter intentionally, and it's up to us to see if we're going to make it correctly, and not only correctly, but if we're going to be able to execute on our intentional visions, right? And I agree with you, it's time for us to go more into design doing and making things really happening, just so that we can get step by step and get into this moment where we can really create something different. So one more question that I wanted to ask you is that you are working with IoT, machine learning, artificial intelligence, and where, because you were talking more broadly about design, but is there any kind of specific area where you think that we should be pushing the boundaries as designers in this space, and more specifically in the future of design with AI? Because the logic of design changes a little bit. We used to be designing and collaborating between humans, right? Now we are collaborating between humans and machine, and it's empowering us so much to kind of take on challenges that are bigger and bigger. The complexity of the solution is going to have bigger and bigger impact. What do you think that is the future of design now that we are kind of being able to use AI more prominently and with for bigger, let's say, challenges?
Absolutely. So let me start with, we have lots of challenges to figure out. And AI doesn't figure it out itself. That's not what the technology does, okay? And one of the things that we need to do as designers is actually reskill ourselves. I do a lot of work with designers across the board who's like, we don't need to know how to code. Well, if you don't need to know how to code, you are not going to be able to be employable in the space of computing. Let's be very clear. You do yourself a disservice, and inevitably your end user a disservice by not knowing how the thing should work. So I'm a very big proponent of designers having what I call command. You want to command the world? Command the command line. Okay. If you want to have command and orchestrate the world, you want to change the world. The only way to change a world that's written in code is to actually understand it. And it's no different than understanding another language. It's just the way that a musician reads music. A designer needs to be able to read code. And so I think that there is something to be said of you can create things like there's no one big solution to every problem. And I think often designers go in with this bold, simplistic thinking that, you know, to complex problems, there's one bullet solution. Well, that's arrogant. It's uneducated. A message alone doesn't solve the problems that face people every single day alone. And it's not just about the talking, right, about the solution, but it's about doing and trying to create the solution, even if it's inelegant at the first time. And so when I think about AI, and when I think about ambient computing and working at this intersection, there are kind of 10 principles that work by. One is that it's invisible. The more invisible it is, the better off we are. That it's embedded, right? That's embedded in ways in our lives that feel natural to the environment they're in. That it's discrete, right? So that I am, and I talk about this all the time, which is I'm not yelling at my chatbot on a train, like, because that's natural. You're not forcing me to give private information in a space that requires privacy, that it's distributed, that what you're doing actually federates, that there's not one solution, but what you're building is an ecosystem. When you have the ability to do that, you're building ecosystems, which means it needs to be modular. It has to be symbiotic, which means it's got to work with other devices, which is really tough. It has to be inclusive. And this one's going to be usually a tough one to swallow, but it has to be conservative in a way, because it has to conserve people's time. It has to be conserve of people's attention to it. It has to do so in a way that actually is a conservation to the environment it lives in the times. Being conservative is about embracing constraint.
Mm.
Okay. It's not about going, hey, there are no constraints to anything that we do. There is constraints in everything that we do. Otherwise you're not designing.
Yeah.
But it is about that aspect of innovation that seeks to push technology to the bleeding edge. And there's an argument to be made about operating within a set of constraints that are, whether they're self-imposed or they're governed by a prevailing technology, like the capabilities of it, or even governed by policy and government makers, right? Those are things that these things must coexist. And you have to understand that you'll make trade-offs. And I look at this, everybody says, well, why can't it do that? And I said, would you like to pay $2,000 for that product? Because that's what it's going to take to get it there. So I think it's just understanding that when you work towards those principles and working with AI, that it becomes really imperative that you understand that you are now working in this new canvas. It's called technology. Data is the paint. Okay. And your ideas and vision are certainly around the experiences, but those experiences will never be real if you can't pick up the paintbrush.
That's really good. I love this analogy, the data is the paint. That's really, really, really clear for us to understand where do you think the design is going. Thank you so much for sharing that. I think that I just wanted to finalize with one last question, our podcast. There is so much for us to, I'll have to watch this episode probably a couple of times to understand everything that what you're saying. It was amazing. In 2019, at the end of 2019, you said that ingenuity was the key of the industry. What would be the key for our industry in 2021 after such a disruptive year?
Everything has changed. And I think the ingenuity that we need to understand is that we need to understand human behavior. There may be a vaccine on the way, right? There is a vaccine on the way, and science is helping us get there. How you design it to get to people is the next step. And I think that the world needs us, right, as designers, and not just for us to be concerning with the practical aesthetic. While that is a wonderful and laudable thing, that is a place of privilege. And I think one of the things that the future of design holds, right, is actually tackling these really tough problems. They're tough, and they need thinkers and doers to go at it and figure the things out. So if I had a theme as we cross into this, is that, you know, there is something to be said of a contactless world that is contacted. It's almost like, it's almost finding solidarity, right? And that you have the power of solo in staying in your bubble to be safe from disease. Because let's be very clear, the world that we live in, this is not the last pandemic that we'll live through. Climate change is here. It produces pandemics. Ones that we're not ready for as humans. And what the earth is really sharing with us right now is it does not need us. We need it. And so if we as designers can focus on those without gimmicks and get to the work of creating sustainability for humankind, I think that's the future of design.
Thank you so much, Joanna. This is really nice. I think we will have a lot to be thinking and designing our next steps as designers for the future, to creating our vision for 2021, and also to repurposing our role in society and in our community as well. Thank you so much for joining us, and we really appreciate to have you here.
Well, and to all of those out there that are listening, gracias, para venirte, y hola a todos mis amigos y amigas. I couldn't be just more honored to be here and be with you all and have this stage to share the thinking of where I think that we can go together.
Speaking with Joanna had felt very special to me. Joanna is a woman design leader and also has a Latinx background, like me. I love to learn that design means ganas in Spanish. Joanna gave me a very important lesson about having sponsorship and not only mentorship. And that the moment that you stop designing as a leader, you stop being a designer. So let's never stop being a designer, please, and only be a great design leader. As she said, as a leader, we always need to be humble and be constantly learning. The world might be feeling upside down, but as Joanna said,
while empathy is really important, I would tell you action is even more important. The ability to deliver a result.
We need action to be the word that is diverse, inspiring, and can lift the best of humans and nature altogether. This is the last episode of this season, and we'll come back soon mid-March next year. If you have any opinion about our show, please write us an email at contact@echos.cc. contact@echos.cc. Thank you and see you soon.